You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 169. Today's episode is a question and answer show where I answer questions from listeners like you. These are always fun and cover a wide range of topics. The last show was all about a new exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection that deals with the Spanish and Caribbean influence in New Orleans. Alfred Lemon was one of the most entertaining guests I've had on the show. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. First up, we have a new sponsor, Sunset Chasers. Do you need help planning a trip to New Orleans? Mallory and Allison, two New Orleans locals, are the travel advisors behind Sunset Chasers, and they can help you plan the perfect vacation to New Orleans. Let them help you make those vacation dreams a reality by scheduling a 30-minute consultation call at no cost. Beyond Bourbon Street listeners save 15% with the code BEYOND15 if you do end up working with them. I used to offer travel planning services, but I had to stop as the podcast grew and as my kids got older and got more involved in extracurriculars. I just couldn't keep up with it. And I've been looking for a couple years now for a partner with a similar view on New Orleans. And I think I found them in Mallory and Allison. Their prices are actually lower than mine were for a similar service, and they're also able to offer a wider range of help if you want a done-for-you experience or if you want to plan travel to places other than New Orleans. In any event, I'll put a link in the show notes, but check them out and let me know how it goes. You can find them at sunsetchaserstravelagency.com/call to set up your first call. And again, I'll put a link. It's going to be over in the show notes at beyondbourbonst.com/169. Today's show is also sponsored by our Patreon supporters. If you love the podcast, the Facebook group, and the work I'm doing, please consider becoming a monthly supporter. You can find out more at patreon.com/beyondbourbonst. We have perks at all levels, and if you join at the $10 level or higher, we'll mention you on an episode. Last but not least, before we jump in, many of you probably know I have a book, The Beyond Bourbon Street Insider's Guide to New Orleans, officially released on May 1st. You can find it online at major retailers like Amazon, Bookshop, Barnes & Noble, and more. In New Orleans, Octavia Books, Blue Cypress has it. I think Frenchman Street Bookstore has it, as well as the OW, a store located at 2850 Magazine Street. Flirty Girl in the French Quarter has it. And one of our partners, NOLA T-Shirt Club on Magazine, also has it. The ones at NOLA T-Shirt Club and at the OW, I have signed all of them. And the ones at NOLA T-Shirt Club, you can order them online. And so, and that way you can get an autographed copy, even if you're not in New Orleans or not going to be here anytime soon. Some of them are also signed by my girls as part, who played a big role in bringing the book to life. So it makes those extra special to me and hopefully to you as well. If you love the show, the podcast, and New Orleans, please consider picking up a copy. And if you want to hear more about the book, check out the episode I did with James Cullen, which was episode 157. And James helped do a lot of the photography in the book. So with that, let's jump into our questions. As I mentioned, it's a Q&A show. I like to do these about once a quarter. We get so many new listeners as well as members of our Facebook group and our Patreon community that it's a good chance to get you involved. I also find the questions challenging and sometimes they result in ideas for future episodes. So let's jump in and see what happens. As always, one perk of being a patron is that your questions come first on these episodes, and we have the first two do come from patrons. So number one, Susan Kraft asks, or says, not long ago, I read a book called Rising Tide by John Barry about the Great Flood of 1927. Do you have any knowledge of the fact that the levee was broken to help save New Orleans, but it destroyed the St. Bernard Parish area? Any chance of a podcast on the river's history? So I have read the book. I think I had recommended it in the episode we did a while back about books, but I don't remember. John and I have exchanged messages several times a couple years ago, and then we just weren't able to connect. He's a part-time resident of the French Quarter, and then he lives somewhere else in the country the rest of the year. I do want to get him on the show. The book essentially tells the tale. It tells two tales, really. It tells the story of whether or not the levees were demolished, were broken to avoid flooding the city. And that appears to be true. Or was true, I should say. The second part is that the book really tells the story of man's desire and efforts to shape the Mississippi River, the flow of the river, and control the river in such a way as to preserve New Orleans and also preserve river traffic and transportation and industry, you know, coming from the upper Midwest all the way down through the South and through the port of New Orleans and out to the Gulf of Mexico. And it talks a lot about some of the fighting that happened about which way it should be done and how it should be done. It's really a good book, and I'm glad for the thing. I'm appreciative of the question, Susan, because it reminds me that I need to reach out to John again. It's actually a show I've thought about doing in August of a year, so around Hurricane Katrina, to give you a different appreciation. But I don't think that I'll wait. I think I'll just reach out to John again and see when he might have the time to come on and do it. So thank you for that. One last thing about it is that it really does kind of tie to this idea of man's efforts to control the river, and the more we do that, the more unintended consequences we have. And we saw that with Katrina, in that there was a canal called the Mr. Go, which essentially was supposed to provide an outlet straight down to essentially the Gulf of Mexico. The problem is that if a storm comes straight up the Mr. Go, then it can come straight into the city. And additionally, that Mr. Go channel has to be constantly dredged. And one of the things that has changed post-Katrina is that it is no longer constantly dredged. And they sort of allude to it. They don't call it the Mr. Go, I don't think, in the book Rising Tide, but they refer to that. So it is a really fascinating story. I will reach out to him. He also did a book, incidentally, about the influenza in the early 1900s. So that, you know, coming off COVID, that's obviously a timely read as well. But thank you for the question. Question number two comes from Melissa, who again is a patron of the show. So thank you, Melissa. Have you read or heard anything about when Madame John's Legacy will open again? So first, for listeners that might not know, Madame John's Legacy is a home that is part of, in the French Quarter, that is part of the Louisiana Museum system. It's been closed for a while, gosh, probably 8 months or more, maybe more, for restoration or repairs. And there is no, the short answer to Melissa's question is there's no currently available public timeline for when it's reopening. I happened to walk by it the other day because I was curious myself, and they are definitely working on it and working on the surrounding street and the area, but there were no signs there that said, you know, coming back and whatever. So I wasn't able to find any information. And I don't always read these questions ahead of time, but I did read this question and I did look online. I wasn't able to find anything. But a couple interesting things about Madame John's Legacy. For one, it is part of the Louisiana Museum system, so that includes 8 or 10 properties, like the Cabildo, the Presbyter, the old U.S. Mint, but it includes Madame John's Legacy. And that building is pretty interesting because it was built in 1788. So two major fires in New Orleans. One was in the 1780s, and then another one was in 1794. So Madame John's Legacy was built or rebuilt in 1788, following the first fire that destroyed about 80% of the city. A second, and allegedly it was owned or lived in by a Spanish officer. And of course, back then we were Spanish, right? The city was Spanish. That's part of the time when Spain controlled New Orleans. Well, a second major fire hit the city in 1794, and that wiped out almost everything that hadn't been wiped out the first time. And one of the things that happened after 1794 was that the zoning codes changed so that everything had to be built in brick. It couldn't be built using wood. And so almost everything you see in the French Quarter is actually Spanish colonial style and not French, even though the original city is called the French Quarter. And obviously it was a relatively short period of time, 60 years, that the Spanish were in control. And we talked about that in the last show with Alfred, actually. But the Spaniards put into place a lot of things, and because of those two fires, there are very few examples of the French period style of architecture. Well, Madame John's legacy is one of them, because it was rebuilt right in between the two fires, and it managed to escape being destroyed in the second fire in 1794. So you have this very old building that is of a different style than almost anything else you see in the French Quarter, that does have a lot of wood construction to it and is a throwback directly to the 1780s. So it looks very much like it did in 1780. I imagine the restoration they're doing is probably some preservation as well as restoration, but it is a pretty unique thing to see. At least before it was closed, entrance to it was free. I don't know if there'll be a small charge afterwards or not. Again, it's a home, so it's not huge, but it is a really interesting kind of step back in time. And it's a place that even a lot of New Orleanians don't know about, so it's definitely worth visiting. I hope it reopens soon. Like I said, it's a quick visit, but it's well worth the stop. When we hear some information, we'll certainly share it in the Facebook community. But a great question, Melissa, and it's timely because I walked by there. In fact, when I went to the Historic New Orleans Collection a couple weeks ago to interview Alfred for the last episode, I intentionally walked by Madame John's legacy because I was curious about how they were doing and where they were at. Let's see. Question number 3 comes from Tara Keith Eckhart. Ideas for single travel in New Orleans. I love the idea of a singles group travel option or suggestions for a fun, cost-effective, and safe experience for a solo traveler. Well, Tara, we did an episode on this topic, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes, but it was way back in episode 45, which I think probably puts that back in 2017. I can't believe it's been that long, but we did. I did it with a guest, a podcast listener, and a friend named Lori Shaw. Lori lives in the upper Midwest, I think, but she enjoys traveling by herself. And it was full of great tips about exactly your question, what to do solo, how safe do you feel, places to go, things like that. Excuse me, I needed a drink of water. In general, so that episode, most of the ideas there are still relevant. Most, if not all, I listened to it in preparation for this show. Most, if not all, of the places are still there. It's held up well, so I would definitely check that out. Again, it's episode 45. But in general, I recommend staying in either the Central Business District or the Warehouse District. Again, it gets you. I tend to recommend those places in general, even for people not traveling solo. I like that it gets you just out of the French Quarter. There's a big range of choices from big corporate hotels, so if you're traveling on points, to small boutique hotels, range of prices. Longtime listeners will remember the old 77 Hotel was a longtime sponsor of the show. I like that location. I like the Renaissance Arts. In my book, I have a whole listing, and it's heavy on Central Business District and Warehouse District hotels, and that's for a reason. I really think it's a good spot for almost any group or solo traveler. Tours that I really like and that I think are perfect for someone traveling solo include Two Chicks Walking Tours, NOLA architecture tours, a kayaking trip in the Honey Island Swamp with Jessica Golly would be a great way to spend a day just outside of New Orleans and get to see something different. And my good friend Elizabeth Pierce, who's been a guest on the show a couple times, has her Drink and Learn tour of the French Quarter. That is just a great time and a way to have a couple drinks and get to hear some history. And Elizabeth is a terrific storyteller. I also think, again, if you like spirits, if you like alcohol, the Sazerac House was not open back then, but is open now, is a really neat free place to tour. You get some cocktails, samples, you get some history. Sazerac House, so the Buffalo Trace Company, whiskey company, bourbon company, is owned by a family that lives here in New Orleans, actually. And the Sazerac drink, of course, was created here in New Orleans, and so there's quite a few ties to the city, but that's a really neat thing. But again, I like those tours, and I think those tours are a way to experience some time with a group of other people and also be on your own. You know, I would also say we get questions, too, from people that are traveling to New Orleans for a conference, you know, and want to come in a couple days early or stay a couple days after, and they might, you know, they might be on their own. And so your question really applies to lots of people like that. If you stay someplace like the Roosevelt Hotel, you'd also have a world-class bar, the Sazerac, downstairs. I wouldn't be afraid to explore. You know, I would give a solo traveler much the same advice I would give any traveler. You know, be smart, be aware of your surroundings. You know, the French Quarter is fine, especially as it gets later in the evening. I don't like people to wander too far from the well-traveled areas in the French Quarter. It's the same advice I follow. You know, I just think that's common sense. It's a big city. So I think that's something to do. If you stay in the Central Business District or the Warehouse District, it's not a far walk to the French Quarter. You can take the streetcar, which is fun for anyone to do, but is a lovely way when you're on your own to explore the city. And that also puts you in a good place to either walk, or if it's nighttime, to take a ride share to the French Quarter. If you went to the Marigny or the Bywater, if you were at a restaurant uptown or along Magazine Street or something like that, really easy to take a ride share. And again, you know, increase the safety, but also no place in the city is very far or very expensive. I actually like to take the streetcar with my family and with the kids, but I also really like to take it by myself too. It's just a really fun way to kind of relax and reflect and see the city, and see kind of one, the grandiosity of the Garden District. But then if you take it all the way to the end, you just see how it changes a little bit in the different neighborhoods. You know, and it's $1.25 each way. I think for a solo traveler, hopping on the ferry, the Canal Street streetcar ferry, and going across to Algiers Point is a really neat thing to do. We've done an episode about Algiers, but even if you did it just for the ride and then paid, again, I think it's $2 or $3 each way, and then paid to come right back, it would be worth it. Or to go for a walk along the levee on the other side and look back at the French Quarter and take some pictures, or just you know, spend some time watching the river traffic. I think that's a really fun thing to do. Some additional advice I would give you is advice I would give everyone, especially post or as we're wherever we're at with COVID: make dinner reservations in advance. The one advantage you would have as a solo traveler is in some places you'd be able to walk in and perhaps eat at the bar without a reservation. But reservations have really become a must. There's just such a shortage of employees in the hospitality industry. Hours are being reduced, so I would certainly call and not trust websites for hours. But many places we didn't need to have reservations, or we didn't need reservations more than a week ahead of time. Now we have to call 3, 4, 5 weeks ahead of time. And again, it's a combination of there are tables. You go in places for dinner and there are tables and they just don't have them filled because they don't have enough staff, or they have reduced hours and created demand. Obviously, they've squeezed the number of tables or the number of times available. And so that, you know, that's pushed out reservations. So you definitely want to think about those things. Also, Tara, you're a member of our Facebook community, the Beyond Bourbon Street crew. So if you post there when you visit, you're almost certainly likely to find people in the group that are willing to meet up. There are plenty of people who I know are married and plenty of people in that group who I know are single. And so I think if you say, hey, I'm looking for some things to do, or I'm interested in doing this, anybody want to do that? I think that you would find a pretty good group of people, all obviously with a common love of New Orleans, who might be willing to meet up with you, you know, and do some things together. So I also try, when I see things like that, when we can make it work, we do try to meet up with folks. That's gotten harder and harder, again, as the kids have gotten involved in more stuff, but we certainly give it a shot. So I hope that's helpful. Go back and listen to the episode with Lori Shaw, though. Really, really good. I think it's held up well. Number four comes from Gary Ogden. Well, I will be in New Orleans the week leading up to Christmas. One, do you have any book signings scheduled? And two, I think based on what I've read, caroling in Jackson Square would be awesome. Have you ever been? And if so, would you recommend? So I need to do a better job of scheduling book signings. I end up doing them on pretty short notice. So I don't have anything scheduled, Gary. I will take that on as a challenge and see if I can set one up sometime right around Christmas, maybe that week before, like you're suggesting. I have done a few at the OW. I've done a few at NOLA T-Shirt Club. One, because they're both sponsors and partners of the show, and in the case of NOLA T-Shirt Club, they're willing to ship the autographed copies out, so that's been really good. I haven't done any at an actual bookstore, though, so I'll work on that. Your second question, Carolyn in Jackson Square. So for everyone else, there, as it implies, they do Christmas caroling in Jackson Square. Yes, we have been. We have been several times. It is one of the most fun events of the year. It's free. As you walk in, they give you a program and they give you a candle. Important tip, bring a lighter or some matches. On the flip side, one of my kids' absolute favorite things is walking around and helping light other people's candles. And so it sort of really contributes to a sense of community. For whatever reason, it seems like every time we go, there's a breeze, and the breeze is enough to blow out the candles. It probably has to do with the proximity to the river, but it's a lot of fun. We know a lot of families that go and spend the day and maybe have an early dinner or a late lunch and then stick around for the caroling. We are fortunate enough that we have good friends who have an apartment in the Puntalba, which is supposedly the oldest continually rented apartment complex, if you will. Those are the red brick buildings on either side of Jackson Square. So we have friends that have an apartment and are gracious enough to invite us to their caroling party each year. So we can not only go caroling, but we have a great view of it from their apartment on the balcony. So that has been really a lot of fun. I highly recommend it. If you or anyone listening are going to be in town when caroling comes up, I have to look up when it is exactly. I'll try to do that now. But if not, you can look it up or I can add it to the show notes. It's a lot of fun. Again, it's free. It's a really nice, a nice event. You know, just a nice community kind of thing. It lasts probably 60 to 90 minutes, I would say, something like that. It looks like it's going to be held this year on December 18th, 2022. And it is an annual event, and I think they have been doing it maybe 30 years, maybe longer. So it's a long time event. Yeah, really a lot of fun. This last year, it was kind of emceed by Mark Romig, who is the voice of the Saints. So if you go to a Saints game and you hear the Inside the Superdome announcer, that's Mark Romig. His sort of signature call is move them chains when the Saints reach a first down. So he, for the last couple of years, has kind of been the MC of the event. A lot of fun. Can't recommend it enough, Gary. Yes, I will work on a book signing. And if I get that set up, I will post it. Your question came through the Facebook group. I'll post it there in the Facebook group. Again, for everyone listening, if you're interested in buying an autographed copy and aren't going to be around during a signing, one, you can reach out to me. And if I'm around, I'm happy to run out and meet you for a drink or coffee or something and sign a book if I can make that work. And if you can't, I've been keeping up with the inventory at both the OW and NOLA T-shirt Club, which are both on Magazine Street. And then again, you have the option of ordering on Magazine Street or ordering from NOLA T-shirt Club to get a personalized copy. I only recently, and by recently I mean in the last 2 weeks or so, got my own shipment of books. So the way the books have worked, the initial run sold out on the second day. Amazon bought out the remainder of the print run. And it took a little while for the publisher to get new print runs done. And then when they did, it took a while for me to order and then get my own copy. So I got a few copies ahead of time, just author copies. And I sent those out to our Patreon supporters at a certain level. But I had no copies. So I didn't have any more to give away or to sell. I now have my first shipment of 50 sitting here. I'm looking at them now. So at some point, I'm in the process of redoing my website, kind of a tangent. Those of you that follow along the Facebook group know that my website's been hacked several times, so it's been up and down, and I'm in the process of having it rebuilt. Once it's rebuilt, I will probably put an option that if you want to order a personalized copy of the book directly from me, you'll be able to do that. But again, I've gone in and signed books continuously at those other places so that there is some availability. So Gary, thank you for that. Before we jump in to the next question, I also wanted to mention that support for the show comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the premier history museum, which is located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a really cool combination blog and online exhibit space, and you can find it at hnoc.org/firstdraft. And the last episode we did, 168, was all about this exhibit I'm going to mention now. And that's the exhibit that highlights the Spanish and Caribbean influence on New Orleans. It just started on October 20th, 2022, and it's going to run through January 22nd, 2023. You know, as I mentioned earlier, we call the original city the French Quarter, but there's this amazing amount of Spanish influence there. The exhibit includes more than 125 pieces from their own collection, as well as from museums in the United States and Spain. So listen to episode 168, then go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. If you listen to the show, Alfred was, again, one of the most enthusiastic guests I've ever had. The catalog for that particular exhibit is written in English and in Spanish, and it's kind of side by side. So page one on the left side is written in English, and on the right side, it's written in Spanish. And they did that in part because there has been such an increase in the Spanish population in New Orleans post-Katrina. I have two daughters, as most of you know. One of them takes French, one takes Spanish. So I'm really excited. The one that takes Spanish, for her to be able to kind of see, you know, obviously the words aren't exact translations, but pretty close. And so that you can read, it's almost like Google Translate in real time. You can read in English on the left side and you can then read the same thing in Spanish on the right. I get a lot of exhibition books and guides just as part of the podcast. You know, and a lot of times they're interesting, but I sort of, they end up in little free libraries afterwards. This is one of just a few that I plan on keeping because I think the book itself is so well done. They have some experts, including but not limited to Richard Campanella, who have written articles or parts of the book to kind of give context. And I just think they've done a great job, not only on the exhibit, but on the book itself. So it's a really interesting book. Again, if you're going to be in town in the next couple months, definitely check out the exhibit. And the Historic New Orleans collection is free. So that's really cool too. So, all right, let's see. Question number five comes from Christy Keaton. How can people get involved with a crew? And she means a Mardi Gras crew based on the spelling. So Christy, almost well, I'll say a lot of Mardi Gras crews accept members from anywhere. And so the easiest way to find out is to go to that crew's website. So for instance, if you wanted to join the crew of Iris, which is an all-female crew, if you Google crew of Iris, you should be able to find their website and then find the registration or membership page. Some crews are separated by gender, so they're all male or all female. There are more and more crews that are co-ed, if you will. There are some crews that are by invitation only, so like the crew of Rex is an all-male crew that parades on Mardi Gras Day, and it's by invitation only, so there's no way to just join. But that's not the rule, it's more the exception. Most of the crews do allow anyone to be a member. And, you know, sometimes you'll find a wait list, so there's also that. But that's the easiest way. Think about a Mardi Gras crew that you like or that you're interested in, or just check out a bunch of them. Arthur Hardy has the Mardi Gras Guide, which we've talked to Arthur many times over the years. If you go to his website, if you look that up, Arthur Hardy Mardi Gras Guide, I think there you can get a list of carnival crews, or you can probably easily Google list of carnival crews. If I can find a link to carnival crews, I will add that to the, I'm making a note here, to the show notes. But the easiest way is just to go look at the website, make a phone call if you have to, or fill out the contact page and find out if they are accepting new members and, you know, what the terms are. They range from a couple of $100 in membership fees to, gosh, the most expensive one I know of is probably a couple $1,000s. And then you have to buy your throws as well. And they have different requirements. You know, some of them do require that you attend meetings, but I think most of them have out of state or out of town members. So, you know, I think there's a lot of flexibility there. So that's the easiest way, Christy. Go to the website of crews that you might be interested in and find out. The other thing is that sometimes you have riding members and non-riding members. So someone might, particularly the ones that have or had wait lists, they might have somebody who is a member and doesn't want to give up their membership but can't ride in a particular year. And so those slots will usually go into a pool where you can be sort of a guest rider for a year. You know, there's usually, again, an application process and a fee, but you can join essentially to take a temporary spot for a year or something like that. So there's a couple ways to get involved that way. And then there are also, you know, post-Katrina, and it seems to grow each year, there are, gosh, dozens and dozens of marching crews. So not parades themselves, but subgroups that march inside of a parade. The crew of Red Beans comes to mind. There's a group called Muffaladas, which is on my mind because there's a question further down about Muffaladas. There's just like walking clubs and crews of every kind of, representing almost anything you can think of. There's the Dead Elvises, I think, is one. So, you know, there's a bunch of those kind of things, too, if you're more interested in marching or participating in that way. But if your interest is in actually riding in a traditional carnival parade, then go to the website, look up the membership information, and go from there. And again, you are a member of the Facebook group. So if you posted the same question in the group and asked, hey, are any of you in a Mardi Gras organization? Could you give me information? I'm quite certain you're going to get a response. And also two of our moderators happen to be in marching organizations within parades. And so they would be able to tell you about that as well. All right, let's see, moving along. And I'm trying to keep notes on where we're at for timestamp purposes. Number six is from Mr. John Jenks, who says, Skyline Architecture, History of CBD, Central Business District Buildings. First buildings with elevators, first buildings with electricity, etc. So I take all this to mean he's just interested in kind of the history, the architectural history of the Central Business District. It struck me, and I'm going to answer the question, John, I took quite a bit of notes, and then I realized, gosh, this probably could be an episode on its own, but we'll answer the question, and maybe someday we'll do an episode. All right, with that having been said, the Central Business District really developed as we know it today as after the Louisiana Purchase. So it was originally known as the Faubourg Saint-Marie, and it was also once the site of Bienville's plantation. But after the Louisiana Purchases, where what happened was many of the, in history, what are known as the New Americans, really mostly Midwesterners, came to New Orleans after the Louisiana Purchase, and they didn't want to mix with the Creoles in the French Quarter, the French Creoles, right? If you think back to that time, you have Midwesterners, you have Americans, they speak English, they want to move, they see a lot of opportunity here after the Louisiana Purchase. They're probably used to being involved in some way in shipping goods down the Mississippi River to the port here in New Orleans. They come to New Orleans. New Orleans is a city at that point that there are lots of, you know, French and Spanish are spoken here, many other languages, again, because it's a port city, but they don't want to mix with the Creoles in the French Quarter. So incidentally, that's also where we get the idea of the neutral ground. In this case, the original neutral ground was that wide expanse on Canal Street, if you've been here, that separates the French Quarter from the Central Business District. And today, it doesn't feel so much like it's separating two neighborhoods, but at the time, it really was, right? If you think of the French Quarter as your neighborhood and the Faubourg Saint-Marie, the Central Business District, it was two neighborhoods. And so the Americans, after 1803, came to New Orleans, and they lived on the other side of Canal Street. And the neutral ground was sort of considered the neutral area between the two. And that name has just stuck. And that's what we call in New Orleans, you know, every part of every green expanse that you would call a median in any other place in the country is a neutral ground in New Orleans. So as you probably won't be surprised, the Central Business District in many ways looks very different than it did back then. You know, plenty of businesses have disappeared, plenty of structures have disappeared. But probably most notably to me, and what I wish, there's a couple of things I wish I could go back in time and see. And actually at the Historic New Orleans Collection, they do have quite a few photographs of that time period, the early to mid 1800s. But there were a lot of churches built, including churches, Protestant churches particularly. But there were churches. There was a church at the corner, I think, of Canal and Bourbon Street, or right near that intersection. There were several churches throughout the, several Protestant churches throughout the Faubourg Saint-Marie. But kind of ironically, the only church that still remains in that area is a Catholic church. And that's St. Patrick's, which was built in 1833. It was built at the behest of and along with support from the Irish community, and coincided with the arrival and settlement of a large population of Irish immigrants. And we also did an episode, gosh, a long time ago, about the Irish in New Orleans and kind of two waves of Irish immigration. But that certainly matched one wave of Irish immigration. And of course, we have an area called the Irish Channel, even further away from the French Quarter than the Central Business District or the Faubourg Saint-Marie. But there were a lot of churches there. And again, in old photos of Canal Street, you can see the steeples, and they're all gone. But St. Patrick's, again, built in 1833, is still there. The most famous structure was the St. Charles Hotel, which is, it was located where Place St. Charles is today. And that's an office building just a couple of blocks off of Canal Street, away from or outside of the French Quarter. It's, I don't know, sort of nondescript. It was built, I think, in the 1990s or late 80s, and it kind of looks that way, just has that feel about it. The St. Charles Hotel, though, was really famous, was a very popular place for people visiting, for politicians, for people of wealth. It was built in 1838, and it survived or was rebuilt after several fires before finally being demolished in 1974. And if there's one building, I really would love to have seen that. The pictures I've seen, it just looked huge. It looked really impressive. It probably, the closest thing to it today is the Roosevelt Hotel in terms of style, I'm guessing. I don't really know. But I would love to have seen it. And also, that part of the Central Business District at that time was really becoming the center of industry. Because you had, you know, unfortunately, we were still in the midst of slavery, but that also meant you know, this was a population center for finances and for trading cotton and other goods. And so there is a building right near there called the Cotton Exchange. So there was all of that. So there's kind of this interesting, right near there, near where the St. Charles Hotel would have been in the middle 1800s or certainly like the 1840s, Carondelet Street became kind of the center of industry. And I mentioned the cotton trade. Many buildings there that are still there were built in the Greek Revival style. So you see the big columns. One style that did pop up, particularly as you cross Poydras Street, is the kind of American style townhouses. And you can still see a bunch of them today. And again, as you go into that side of the central business district and then sort of keep wandering back into the warehouse district, you'll see plenty of those, which are really common in the central business district, but not so common in other parts of New Orleans. So that to me is a pretty interesting thing about it. From the 1870s to 1920s, I guess, the CBD really boomed. Skyscrapers started to appear, which gets to the heart of your question. Electric lighting was introduced in 1883, and the first electric streetcar ran in 1893. So, again, we've had streetcars since the 1830s, but they originally were pulled by mule or by horse. So it wasn't until 1893 that there was the first electric streetcar ran or started in the Central Business District. I couldn't find information on the first building with an electric elevator, but my sense is it was probably the Hennen Building, which is now the Latter & Blum Building at Carondelet and Common. So again, if you think about Carondelet Street as being the center of commerce, makes sense. It was the first quote-unquote skyscraper. It was 10 stories tall. So, you know, it's interesting through today's view to think of a 10-story tall building as a skyscraper. But if you went back into the 1800s, I guess that qualified. My guess is it probably had the first elevator because it was 10 stories. They actually later added an 11th story. Around 1908, and I'm kind of jumping geographically, the Central Business District by New Orleans standards is relatively a large swath of land. I think it was 1908 or certainly around 1908, the Pythian Temple was built. And that was headquarters to a social and benevolent club that one inspired the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club. But today that building houses the Pythian Market, kind of in ode to it. So it had become apartments or something else over the years. And then 5 or 6 years ago, they did a ton of work on it. And they brought it back to an event space and kind of a food hall, food market sort of thing. But it was significant for a lot of reasons, and not the least of which was the fact that many famous jazz musicians played there. It was also in the area known as Black Storyville, and it essentially abutted Storyville proper, which was the historic red light district in the late 1890s, and then the first decade of the 20th century, where prostitution was legal. So you had this, there used to be a train station near there. You had this kind of segregated, but right up against each other, red light districts of quote unquote White Storyville and Black Storyville. You also had, that's really the heart of where the Pythian Temple is probably pretty darn close to ground zero of where jazz music as we know it today was formed. And you had all the jazz greats, the jazz legends playing in those clubs. They would have played at the Pythian. The Eagle Saloon was close by. There's a mural not far from there showing Sidney Bechet and several other jazz greats, all right in that one little space. And in part, it was because jazz musicians played in the brothels. You know, the brothels had, and again, I keep saying this, but we've done almost 170 episodes. We've covered a lot of ground. In Storyville, there was live entertainment in the brothels, you know, so people would go in, they would expect to hear music. And that might be anything from sort of, I'm not sure about opera, but along the kind of classical music to this new thing called jazz. And many of the people we would associate with being the creators and the founders of the New Orleans jazz style of music would have spent many hours performing in clubs and brothels and places right along there. And so the Pythian Market was really important in the black community, but really important in the history of music, New Orleans music in general. And so again, now it's a food, food court, food hall, I guess is what they call it. It's a pretty neat space. It has an event space. I don't remember if they've put apartments in there, but it was a big deal. And when it was built again, right at the end of the Storyville sort of time period, it was a big deal. Then you kind of jump forward. The Central Business District just has this history of going up and down. In 1960s, white flight hit the area with the end of segregation. If you recall, again, we did an earlier episode. That was also the time of debate about bringing the interstate into downtown and into the French Quarter and along the riverfront in the French Quarter. At least one of the arguments for it was meant to stimulate business and growth along Canal Street and along the Central Business District. There are lots of studies that argue that that wouldn't really help. Some argued that it would. Obviously, it kind of depended on what side you were. If you listen to the episode, you know that those plans were defeated, and instead the Claiborne Avenue corridor was created, which essentially destroyed this real hub of African-American businesses and immigrant businesses as well to make room for the interstate. So in the long run, it wasn't put in the French Quarter or along the river. It was put along Claiborne Avenue. And again, we went into that in great detail in an earlier episode. But that was really in the heart of the Treme, this historic African-American neighborhood, and it really destroyed hundreds of businesses. In fact, today there is a push to try to remove that portion of the interstate as a means of kind of bringing back community there. So that happened in the 60s, and then the 70s, we kind of reversed course, and we saw the oil boom, and of course New Orleans, along with other, you know, other areas in the South, Houston comes to mind. You know, there was a renewed interest in the CBD. The big oil companies were here. One Shell Square on Poydras Avenue was completed in 1972. And at the time, it was the tallest building in the Southeast at 51 stories and just under 700 feet. I think 697 to be exact. One of the things that really stood out about it, and even today it's called the Whitney Hancock Building, but it still stands out with its limestone exterior. So it's a bright white limestone, particularly on a sunny day in New Orleans. It's hard to walk by if you don't have sunglasses on because it just is pretty blinding. But it was the biggest, for about 5 or 6 years, the biggest or tallest building in the southern United States. And then a building was built in Atlanta that superseded it 5 or 6 years later. But it's still used. It's still, again, kind of the heart of the Central Business District. And now, again, it houses Whitney Hancock Bank, among many other tenants. Probably, to me, the most interesting architectural example in the Central Business District is no longer with us. And that's the Rivergate. It was located at the site that is currently where Harrah's Casino is. It was built in 1968, and kind of the focal point was this curving, undulating roof that spanned 253 feet and was only 5 feet thick. It was always pretty ugly, at least to me, remembering it. At the same time, it was really praised by architects as kind of this engineering feat and this really, I don't know what the technical style of it was called, but it was very sort of period appropriate to the 60s. And it was demolished in 1995, even though there was a lot, there were a couple of years of protests by preservationists about its importance. It was the convention center before we had what is now the Ernest Morial Convention Center along the Mississippi River. It was nowhere near as big as that. One interesting thing about it is that they created a tunnel underneath it, and so that tunnel still exists. It's amazing to me that someone decided to dig a tunnel in a city that is half of the city is below sea level, and that tunnel, that location, is only a few blocks from the Mississippi River. So I cannot imagine deciding to do that to build a tunnel anywhere here in New Orleans, but to build a tunnel that close to the Mississippi River, it just, you know, I'm not an engineer, but it just seems like a crazy risky idea. But that tunnel is still there. And I think the idea at one point was to use it for parking. I know that Harrah's Casino uses it. I think there's a way to get from the Harrah's Hotel to the casino using that tunnel. I don't think that visitors are allowed to use it, but I think they do use it probably for mechanical things and stuff like that. But it was definitely, at least in my lifetime, kind of the most interesting or unique architectural feature in the Central Business District. Again, I've kind of gone on there a bunch, and again, this could probably be an episode in itself, but I hope that it gives you some idea of, one, the variety of architecture, how it's changed over time as immigrants have come to New Orleans, and just different industries have kind of come and gone, and the uses of the buildings in the Central Business District over the years. I didn't even mention that the area, well, I did mention this earlier, but in this piece, that it's really the place that I recommend most frequently for visitors, especially if you want to escape the noise of the French Quarter. And I mean places to stay. There's a big range of accommodations in the Central Business District and the Warehouse District. You're close to the French Quarter. You can hop on the streetcar easily. You can get uptown or to Magazine Street. You can get to the Superdome for a game or the Smoothie King Center for an NBA game or a concert. It's just a really good location. And it's easy to walk to, say, the French Quarter, but it's also, if you just want to get out of that noise, that, you know, particularly on weekends when the French Quarter is really loud till all hours in the morning, I think it's a really good combination of spots. There's good restaurants nearby. And again, they have everything from the chain hotels to some really nice boutique hotels and kind of a big range of prices as well, which is nice. So I find that probably 90% of my recommendations are for hotels in that area. And I haven't added it up in my book, but I think that 90% probably holds pretty true in the book too. So something to keep in mind. I hope that that helps John answer the question. Again, there's a lot to know about the Central Business District, and I've added that to the list of possibilities for maybe a future episode. That might be one to get a historian on and talk about the history of the Central Business District and how it's changed. And I wonder how much work Richard Campanella has done on that as well, since it kind of crosses into his interest in geography and sort of anthropology, you know, and changes in community over time. So we'll see. All right. Question number 7, Nikki, I'm going to take a shot at your last name, Kazalka. I hope that's right, Nikki. I've been to New Orleans a handful of times and will be back for my birthday the first weekend in December. As I dream about muffaladas, they are simply the best. Where is the best muffalada? And then she questions, how do you spell it? Also, we're staying in the Marigny. What are things and eats not to be missed in the area? Okay. So first of all, it's spelled M-U-F-F-A-L-E-T-T-A, muffalada. Muffaletta, some people will say, but most New Orleans say muffalata. So the best is highly subjective. The famous, and in my opinion, the best, comes from Central Grocery on Decatur. They've been closed, the building has been closed since Hurricane Ida, though I think that they are selling them from Frank's Grocery, which is like two storefronts down. But in my opinion, they're the best. Napoleon House makes a really good one, and they toast theirs, which I think is key. It's the one thing that I wish Central did. And even when we get muffaladas from Central Grocery, we bring them home and toast them in the oven for a few minutes. It makes a big difference. But Napoleon House does toast theirs unless you ask them not to. So that's an option. My wife Marie loves the one at Cafe Maspero's, which is not to be confused with Pierre Maspero's. So Cafe Maspero's is also on Decatur, but it is closer to Canal Street. So it's on the other side of Jackson Square than is Central Grocery. She's pretty adamant about it too. So Marie's favorite neighborhood restaurant is Clancy's, and her favorite muffalata is Cafe Maspero's. And I've just told you two of the most important things to a successful relationship with Marie. Another one, that's interesting is Liuzas. They have an interesting take on it. So Liuzas is a neighborhood restaurant near, there's two. There's Liuzas by the track, which is very close to the fairgrounds if you go there for Jazz Fest. And then there's Liuzas off of, I think it's Bienville Street in Mid-City. They make kind of a, I forget what they call it, but they make a mofalata on a po' boy. And so it's plenty big enough for two or three people, and has all the ingredients of a muffalata. So olive salad, olive oil, various Italian meats, cured meats, and cheeses. But they serve it on a toasted po' boy bread that's probably 12 or 16 inches long and then cut into small little pieces. I think it's pretty good. And then there's one out in Metairie off of Metairie Road called Norjo's, which is a little Italian grocery store market kind of thing. And they make a really good muffalata. We don't get it often, mostly because we don't think about it. It's actually not that far from where we live. I don't know that I would make a trip out to Norjo's. I think the ones I've mentioned, particularly if you're in the Marigny, are great. But for other people listening, and if you have a car and you wanted to sort of try a couple different ones, and or if you're, say, visiting relatives, you're going to be at Metairie, Norjo's makes a really good one. So there's a bunch of examples. Take your pick. If you do, let us know. And certainly, if you have, Marie doesn't listen to the show, but she is active in the Facebook group. So you could certainly win some points there if you point out that you went to Cafe Maspero's, or if you ask her opinion there. I'm sure that's what she's going to say, though. Your second question was about the Marigny, and we have, again, gosh, I'm a broken record. We've done a whole episode about the Marigny. I think things not to be missed in that area, and I'm going to blend the Marigny and the Bywater there, which are going to aggravate people that live in one and not the other. They are two separate but adjacent neighborhoods. The Marigny, of course, is adjacent on one side with the French Quarter and on the other side with the Bywater. Neighborhood bars, there's a ton of them there that are really great. Lots of street art, particularly in the Bywater, but also in the Marigny, where the two intersect, and this kind of gets touches on another question we're going to hit in a little bit, but there is the site where Homer Plessy boarded the train and then was arrested. There's also a mural there about Plessy. There's a studio there called B Mike's, which has limited hours, but is well worth going look at the art installations there. And a lot of the street art you see right near there is done by the artist known as B Mike. He's somebody else I need to go interview for the podcast, actually. Again, lots of bars, lots of neighborhood kind of hole in the wall bars there. Also in that area, I think the food technically is Honduran. It's called Alma's Cafe, A-L-M-A, apostrophe S. Really great breakfast or lunch spot. Right on Esplanade, you have Bufa's, which is a casual restaurant that has lots of live music, really great music. And because it's a restaurant, it's also kid-friendly. There is Brew Carré, which is a very small a craft beer place that makes excellent beer. If you then drift into the Bywater, you have Parlo, which is, I think, probably one of the very best craft brewers in New Orleans. Right near there, right around the corner from Parlo, you have Bacchanal, which is a wine bar that has a lot of open-air seating, and they have live music most days of the week starting in the afternoon. You can also walk up to the Mississippi River levee right there and walk along the canal right out to the edge where the canal hits the Mississippi River. And that's kind of known locally as the end of the world. And that's a great place to, one, there's always people out there with dogs and letting the dogs run around and play frisbee and whatever. But it's a good place to see the river traffic and kind of get that sense of walking uphill to get to the river. Which I think we take for granted here, but maybe is a little unnerving, but does kind of give you a sense of you know, how we sit geographically relative to the water level here in the city. Is this the Marigny or the Bywater? People local are gonna fuss at me, but there's a great place called Bratz Yall, which is sort of a German beer hall Right next to it is Pizza Delicious. And right next to those two is a really good record shop. If you're into vinyl, Euclid Records, really good people and a really great knowledgeable staff and lots of good finds there. Elizabeth's is close by, which is a good lunch brunch spot. Definitely gets crowded, so you got to plan for that. There's a really neat park right along the waterfront there. So again, we did a whole episode, but there's a ton of things to do right there in the Marinette and the Bywater. You could easily make, you could spend several days just wandering around there, drifting into the French Quarter, bars along St. Claude Avenue. There's a really nice, expensive, upscale, hard to find French restaurant called N7 that gets great reviews. That's there if you want something upscale. There is a Thai place called Budsi's Thai that is my favorite Thai place in the city. That's really great. I could go on and on. There's a ton of stuff there. There is a, I don't know where you're staying, but there's a little bed and breakfast right off Frenchman or right on Frenchman Street called R&B Bed and Breakfast. That's a really neat location, and you are right in the heart of the clubs on Frenchman Street, but just a block away. So, you know, not in direct sort of, I'm sure you hear some of the music, but you're a few, you know, you're a few steps, a block or two away, but you're right there. So if you want to wander down there into the clubs there, lots of great clubs for live music, not only jazz music, but all kinds of music. So there's a lot of things to do right there. You won't be disappointed in that choice at all. The Hotel Peter and Paul has a terrific bar and also a little coffee shop in the front of it. That's also another great place to stay. So as you can see, it's why we did a whole episode on it. Lots to do there, but you won't have any trouble at all having a good time there. Let us know in the Facebook group again where you go to get a muffalata and tag Marie in that, if you would. Let's see. Question number 8. I always wonder how long this is going to last, and we're already over an hour. This one comes from Jeff Hermanson. Maybe do an episode on NOCA. Great program, world-class alumni. So thanks, Jeff. That probably is a topic worthy of an entire episode. So for everyone else, NOCA stands for the New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts. It's a school that was founded in 1973, and it offers instruction in culinary arts, dance, media arts, filmmaking, audio production, music, theater, visual arts, creative writing, basically any kind of artistic endeavor you can think of, as well as all the regular curriculum you would encounter in high school. The difference in a regular high school. Graduates include people like Branton and Wynton Marsalis, Harry Connick Jr., Terrence Blanchard, and Wendell Pierce, who was on The Wire and the HBO show Tremé, among many other graduates. So it does have, you know, in its history, it has a pretty distinguished group of graduates. I think something like 98% of its graduates go on to college. Most, if not the overwhelming majority of those, continue into the fine arts in some way or another. And again, the results speak for themselves. Kids that go, it's a rigorous admissions process. Kids that go and succeed do very well in the arts, regardless of kind of, you know, that's all over the place in terms of whatever type of arts it is. I do like the idea, Jeff. It's one I hadn't thought of. And I'm going to add that to the list to check out and reach out to them and see if they'd be open to doing an episode, because I think it's probably something not a lot of people know about unless you either are a New Orleanian and or have a child that actually went to school there. So thank you for that. Question number 9 comes from Claire G, G-E-E. And Claire asks, any thoughts on self-guided bike rides around town over the holidays? Off the beaten path, but safe and away from lots of traffic. Is that too much to ask? Most bike rental companies will provide you with maps and suggestions, so I would take their advice. You know, they're going to be in the business of trying to deal with exactly what you just asked. From my lens, I think, well, let me say this. There have been a lot of efforts over the last few years to make New Orleans more bike friendly. And I think on the one hand, it is more bike friendly. I also think New Orleans has a long way to go to be a truly bike friendly city. I've lived in other places, including Northern Virginia. I worked in the district for a long time, and the bike paths and the ability to get around, whether it was commuting or recreational biking, were just phenomenal. So maybe my expectations are unreasonable. I don't know. I think New Orleans has a long way to go to be that kind of city. Having said that, there is this really nice path that circles City Park. It goes along Bayou St. John. It connects to the Lafitte Greenway, which is a path that gets you from downtown into the mid-city kind of Lakeview area. You could connect all those together and ride out to Lake Pontchartrain. So you could get a pretty, if you rented a bike, say at a place in the Marigny, for instance, to bring up the question that Nikki raised about the Marigny, you could pretty easily get onto the Lafitte Greenway, ride out to mid-city, go along Bayou St. John, and or wander through City Park, go all the way out to Lake Pontchartrain, kind of follow the perimeter of the park and come back, and you could have, how long is that? That's probably a 22-mile bike ride, would be my guess. The Lafitte Greenway in one direction is just a couple miles, so you could certainly combine it. Those are different things. I think the bayou is really interesting. There's a range of architecture along it. You have City Park along the other side. The bayou is just always kind of a special place to me because it is the way that Bienville came into the city. And then they basically portaged their way down a couple miles to the location that we now know as the French Quarter. So that's always just kind of, when we go by there, I think about that a lot. So that's my recommendation there. But go to or look up a bike rental place. Some of them have maps online, and certainly they're in the business of trying to help you have the best experience you can doing that. So I would recommend that. And then our 10th and last question comes from Terry Smith. And this is a challenging one. Recommendations on where to eat for non-seafood eating vegetarians that will also make meat eaters happy. When I first read this, I thought, I'm not sure. But I'm going to take your question as meaning not specifically a vegetarian restaurant, but rather a restaurant where you can find good vegetarian options. And I certainly talk in the book about vegetarian options. And we did an episode a couple years ago about eating vegetarian in New Orleans. And some of those places have come and gone. And in some cases, they've been replaced with other places. But that is one resource. But that was very much focused on the vegetarian as opposed to trying to sort of make all parties happy and then also excluding seafood. But the Pelican Club in the French Quarter, they seem to go out of their way to always have either vegan or vegetarian options on the menu. And by that, I mean beyond throwing together a plate of vegetables. I mean actual dishes. Muriel's is another one right on Jackson Square in the heart of the French Quarter. They typically have at least one vegetarian entree and several appetizer options. I looked at their menu this morning in preparation for the show, and they have a wild mushroom gnocchi with roasted mushrooms, futsu squash, toasted pumpkin seeds, truffle cream, and fried sage. That sounds pretty darn good, and I am far from a vegetarian. Merrill, which is an Emeril Lagasse restaurant named for his daughter in the Central Business District, has several options and seems to always have several vegetarian, if not vegan, friendly options. Obviously, Italian places are going to be good places. There's a place right across the street from the World War II Museum called Gianna's. In terms of casual, I mentioned Liuz's earlier, and they have a delicious fried eggplant, as well as typical New Orleans food that would include meat. The other night we ate at one of our favorite places on Magazine Street. We ate at Joey K's. They have a dish called Eggplant Napoleon. It has crawfish in it, but I think they add the crawfish. So you could probably get it without crawfish. And it's basically fried eggplant on top of fettuccine Alfredo and then it has crawfish tails in it. So you could probably order that dish without crawfish. And I think that they, I'm trying to work from memory here, I think that they have several dishes that might fit the bill as well, but I would check. But they have a pretty large menu. So that's a few that come to mind. There's a brand new, in the Hotel St. Vincent, I have not been yet. There is an upscale Italian place called San Lorenzo that some friends of ours were raving about. I would imagine that would be a good place as well. But again, in the French Quarter, you got the Pelican Club and Muriel's. The Pelican Club is in an alley, and right next to it is a vegetarian place that is very, very well regarded. But again, for this, I sort of decided to challenge myself and think about places that are not specifically vegetarian, but that would have legitimately good vegetarian options. Saba is another one, Mediterranean restaurant, uptown in New Orleans on Magazine Street. So Mediterranean food, so, you know, hummus and things like that, but also a good range of meat and meatless dishes. So I think those are a pretty good range. I hope that helps, Terry. And again, your question, like several of these, if you're a member of the Facebook group, it's a really good resource. It's an active community. We have about 14,000 people there now. So, you know, particularly when you ask questions about restaurants, I rarely chime in because they get so many questions or so many answers so quickly, but I hope that helps. We've been going at this now for about an hour and 10 minutes, so we're going to wrap it up. I want to say thank you to our sponsors, particularly the New Orleans Collection, our Patreon supporters, all of those of you who have bought my book and all those companies that are carrying the book, our newest sponsor, Sunset Chasers. Again, check out Mallory and Allison if you're planning a trip to New Orleans. And again, the Historic New Orleans Collection. That last show was an awful lot of fun. I'm about to record another episode with an author that published a book through them as well. Can't say enough about the Historic New Orleans Collection. They do some really great stuff. It's free. Just a great resource as well. So I also really want to say thank you to everyone who submitted a question, whether you're a Patreon supporter or a member of the Facebook community. It's always a challenge for me to do these. It's fun to do them. I hope that they're useful for you. They cover a wide range of topics like this one did. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to my girls to close us out. And by the way, longtime listeners might know the recordings of them are old. They really need to be updated. I think the kids were probably 5 or 6 years old, and they just celebrated their 11th birthday this week. So time flies, and we need to update that. But until we do, I'm going to say thank you and goodbye and hand it over to the girls.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.